Did you know that students get it free? The Irish Times offers a free digital subscription to all full-time undergraduates. Keep up to date for free with quality journalism and reporting. Claim yours today at irishtimes.com/subscribe/student.
It's Friday, September the 23rd, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. We thought it might be a useful exercise to do a wrap of the week's events in politics before the weekend arrives. And so here we are with Pat Leahy and Harry McGee from the Irish Times political staff. Hello to you both.
Hi, Hugh.
So, Pat, there's a lot of budget stuff around. We could spend an hour talking about it, but that's not what this podcast is about. What do we know that's interesting that's come out in the last couple of days for next week's budget?
Well, bucket loads of speculation, Hugh. You will, you know, if you've managed to avoid the newspapers all week, you won't know what's coming up in the budget. But then again, if you've been reading the newspapers all week, you won't know for certain what's coming up in the budget either, because all measures that have been reported are being discussed. Lots of speculation, but decisions won't really be made, won't really be finalised until over the weekend. What I can tell you, though, is two things for sure about the budget. The first is that it'll be the biggest non-COVID budget ever by some distance. It will be, I reckon, between 10 and 11 billion when you factor in the budget proper, that is the spending, tax cutting plans for 2023, and the package of cost of living measures, which will be announced on the same day, and many of which will take effect before the end of this year. I think that will be between 3 and 4 billion euros. So you're looking at a package of somewhere between 10 and 11, all told. So what do we know about it? We know that there will be tax changes, adjustments to the tax thresholds, the bans, and to the tax-free allowance. And they will have the material impact of bringing down the level of tax that many middle-income earners would pay. There'll be a big welfare package in the budget. I don't think it's going to go as far as the 20 euros that many organisations which work with people affected by poverty and deprivation are advocating. Lots of those organisations saying it has to be 20 euros. I don't think it's going to be anything like 20 euros on the flat rate. But in fact, I don't think it's going to reach 15 euros on the flat rate. But there will, I think, be a big once-off welfare package as part of the cost of living measures, which may involve like a double payment of money rates. And that, I think, we're likely to see pretty soon.
So, Harry, there's no real Goldilocks moment in this budget, is there? Some people are going to say it's far too much and it's profligate spending. Some people are going to say it's not enough to address the problems that people are going to face this winter. So how does the government navigate its way through that?
Well, I mean, the problem is that it's just become an auction now. I was at the Sinn Féin pre-budgetary submission this morning, and they've upped the ante. I think the overall government package between the cost of living and the budget will be in the region of about 10 billion euro, give or take, whereas Sinn Féin is talking about 13.5 billion. And I'm sure the other opposition parties will also be advancing budgetary and cost of living proposals that will be well in excess of 10 billion euro. And unfortunately, you know, when it comes to the public are never satisfied. So whatever is offered to them by government, whatever the hue of that government is, and I'm sure if Sinn Féin goes into government in the future, I think they will begin to recognise the features of this phenomenon as well, that it's not enough. So we've had some extraordinary promises. I was actually looking through the Sinn Féin package this morning, and I'm not criticising Sinn Féin in particular because everybody is doing it, including the government. And it reminded me of something akin to the late toy show, you know, just giveaway after giveaway after giveaway. And of course, most of it is necessary because we have been hit by a double or triple whammy of different phenomena this year, from the war in Ukraine to the increase in energy prices, to steep rates, rises in inflation, both food inflation and non-food inflation, which has gone into double digits. And in tandem with that has been an increase in interest rates. We saw an increase of 0.75% proposed by the Fed this week. The Swiss have gone up from below zero to above zero for the first time in well over a decade. And there are prospects that interest rates will continue to rise in the euro area. The ECB may increase interest rates again in the new year. So against all of that, people find that they have less money in their pocket and they're finding it harder to make ends meet. And the government was blessed this week, if I may use that religious term, blessed this year by virtue of the fact that corporation tax delivered a bonanza again for them. So instead of running a 5 billion deficit, the state now is looking at a surplus in the range of 4 billion to 4.5 billion euro. And that has given both the government and all the opposition parties wiggle room or a room for manoeuvre in terms of spending. And they are all promising very lavish spending proposals to essentially to try to lance the wound that will be brought by increased energy prices during the winter month. I think the big difficulty won't really come for the government between now and February. I think the proposals in the budget will probably be welcome. The difficulty may come in February or at the end of February if prices do not begin to recede and if inflation continues to rise or stay or plateaus and if interest rates continue to rise, they will be left with a bit of a challenge in terms of how are they going to see out the rest of 2023.
Indeed, and into 2024, possibly, depending how all these things panned out. But, Pat, Harry brought religion into the conversation there, and religion was in the news this week. The demographics in Northern Ireland have been changing for many years, but there's a landmark moment in the results of the census in Northern Ireland that, for the first time in the history of that political entity, there are more Catholics than Protestants.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary historical moment, really, when you think of the origins of the Northern State. It's, you know, its specific design, gerrymandering, exclusion of the three of the majority Catholic counties from the nine counties of Ulster into the Northern Ireland state 100 years ago with the specific intention of making it a Protestant state for a Protestant people. Now, we have known that this point is coming for some time. It's hardly a surprise in that regard. But it's one of these things, I suppose, that is kind of a shock, but not a surprise, if you know what I mean. Now, I suppose it's long been an assumption in some kind of nationalist stroke Republican circles that, you know, the route to a united Ireland was essentially through outbreeding Protestants in the north. And, you know, many Catholics have been enthusiastically pursuing that particular route to their political objective. But I think one of the interesting things that's happened and the thing that complicates the picture politically somewhat is that, you know, we by now have a fairly well-established trend of political allegiance diverging from, you know, religious or cultural background. We've seen in the last election, you know, two important things happening in the north, not just the supremacy of Sinn Féin as the largest party, but the rise of the Alliance, signifying the rise of the people in the middle ground, the neithers, people who describe themselves as neither Catholic nor Protestant, and certainly not spancelled by the traditional political and constitutional aspirations of those two camps. So, you know, there's been somewhat of a note of nationalist triumphalism about this and the assumption that it brings a united Ireland closer. And I think the picture is a bit more complex than that and will require a lot more examination of it.
I think it's a good deal more complex than that, Harry. I mean, looking at it, it seems to me, as Pat says, politics is being decoupled a bit from the traditional sectarian identities in Northern Ireland in all different kinds of ways. And the fact is that the nationalist parties, SDLP and Sinn Féin between them, only command the same proportion of the vote now as they did 20 years or so ago in Northern Ireland. So there is not necessarily an inevitable political movement. And I wonder increasingly how useful it is, this, you know, sectarian head count exercise. And even, you know, what Catholic or Protestant mean. I gather, I mean, you were at the Sinn Féin press conference and Mary Lou McDonald was asked about her religious practice, which seemed to me to be rather an odd thing to be asked about. What was that about?
She was asked about her religious practice and she refused to answer it on the basis that it was personal to her and that it didn't have a public dimension. And she said the same went for both Piers Doherty and Mairead Farrell, who were on the stand for her. And she said that it reflected, you know, the Catholic Protestant thing. She said it reflected the crude sectarian way in which the Northern Ireland state had been founded, that people were branded according to their religion, and that was the basis on which the head count was made. I think that Catholic and Protestant may no longer be the working metric. Those who are a Catholic background probably comprise a lot of people now who are non-believers and who are certainly non-churchgoers and for who would consider themselves probably to be more secular than religious. I think the interesting question related to identity, people were asked about what they felt they were they British, were they Irish, were they Northern Irish, were they none of the above? And it was salient that those who considered themselves British had fallen substantially since the last census, from 40% to 32%, while there was a smaller but comparable increase in those who considered themselves Irish, from 25% to 29%. But what was interesting to me was that 20% said that they were Northern Ireland Irish only, which to me is a very, very big buffer zone. And I think, you know, those who think that a simple majority of Catholics will trigger a border poll, that will trigger some kind of path towards a united Ireland of some form, will be mistaken, because the actual mix of dispositions is far more complex than that. And, you know, you cannot assume that those who assume, who say they are Northern Irish only, have any particular bias towards linking up with the South. Actually, interestingly, one of the things in the budgetary proposals for Sinn Féin, there was an omission, there was no reference to Micheál Martin's Shared Island initiative. Sinn Féin said that's existing spending, so they're not going to tamper with it. They think the initiative itself is useful insofar as it goes, but you can take it as writ that if Sinn Féin were to get into government, the Shared Island unit would be decommissioned and put beyond use very quickly indeed. But the more you look at the figures on the North, the more you think of Scotland and the referendums they've had and the surveys that show that there's a favourable disposition towards independence. But when it comes to an actual referendum, those who have been advocating for Scottish independence, in the last one at least, fell far short of that goal.
Indeed, and this is a subject which our listeners will be aware we've covered a lot in the past, and I'm sure that we will cover in increasing depth into the future as well. Pat, briefly, if you wouldn't mind, I mean, there were decisions made over the last couple of weeks that might have much more far-reaching fiscal consequences for the country than next week's budget. The decisions made about the way in which pensions are going to be supported financially into the future were huge, huge ramifications.
Yeah, I think, well, of course, some of those decisions were kind of kicked into row Z as well, and I'll try insofar as it is possible, because it is the mission statement of our Friday podcast, to give people a quick catch up on the week. But to the extent that anyone,
please do bear that in mind.
The extent that anyone can give a quick catch up on pensions policy, I will attempt to do so. No, again, this was something that had been flagged in recent months, the government's new pension policy, in which it decided against the recommendations of its own expert commission to decided against increasing the mandatory pension age. Instead, the mandatory pension age will stay at 66. You can't retire until you can't get the state pension, rather, until you reach 66. But you will be able, if you so desire, to retire at 67 or 68 or 69 or indeed 70. And in return for working longer, you will get a bigger state pension, approximately 5-6% a year better if you choose to stay in the workforce and not draw down your state pension during those years. What the government didn't say is how specifically is it's going to pay for this. So we're told that will be paid for by increased PRSI contributions, but it didn't spell out what they will be. Instead, it's going to have an actuarial review of the Social Insurance Fund, which is the fund through which your taxes or those part of your social insurance taxes end up paying not your pension, but the pension of current pensioners, because public pensions and indeed public sector pensions are paid on a pay-as-you-go basis rather than the idea, say, in the private sector where you would save money for your put it in a pension pot, which you can then draw down when you retire, which is all of which is a rather long-winded way of saying that it's a current rising costs of pensions is a current expenditure problem. And if your pensions bill is getting bigger, which it will because people are living longer and there will be more people drawing down state pensions, then your tax revenues have to go up in the future to pay for that. The unfairness that some people might say at the heart of this is that younger people will be paying longer, will soon be paying higher taxes for older people's pensions. So
not the only generational unfairness which people have pointed out to in the current structures of Irish society, but also Harry, briefly to you, if you would mind, even briefer than Pat, if such a thing were possible. You were quite taken by Micheál Martin's speech last night. You thought there was perhaps a valedictory tone to it?
I did. I think there's 2.5 months left in his period as Taoiseach. And I just thought his speech last night was probably one of the best speeches that he's made over the past 2 years as Taoiseach. I thought there was a focus on a stridency to it that had not been evident before. I thought he was particularly good in terms of outlining the supposed role of the United Nations versus the actuality or the reality, which fell far short of his ambitions. And he was particularly scathing about the Security Council and about how the Security Council really, in a way, distorts the charter of the United Nations and undermines its very being. And he says that the Charter can deliver results, but at the moment, the way in which the United Nations is configured, as we all know, just cannot achieve any of that. And he instanced some of the initiative Ireland has worked with in relation to with Norway in relation to Syria, in the Tigray region of Ethiopia and other places as well, to ensure that humanitarian aid can continue to reach, you know, the millions of people who need it. And he said that at every turn, that good work and that positive work and that humanitarian work was compromised by others who were following their own particular narrow geopolitical agendas. So, you know, just as a speech, I thought it was very good. I thought the points he made were very strong. I think he delivered it very well. So it was almost like a valedictory speech, as you said, Hugh, from him. Perhaps the strongest speech he has made that I have heard he has made as Taoiseach.
We wanted to finish off the podcast today, because it is a Friday, to ask each participant here what was their favourite Irish Times article this week or something that they'd recommend to our listeners. Pat?
I was quite taken with Keith Duggan's reports, not quite one article, but a series of them, reports from London in advance of and on the day of the Queen's funeral. I mean, I found the coverage, I was slightly mesmerised by it for a period of time on Monday. I found when I was having my lunch that I was like simply watching a procession of soldiers carrying the coffin, and had been doing so for about half an hour before I realised what I was doing. And I thought Keith's... I thought his reports really captured the sense around London, not just on the streets, but the, you know, the sense of an historical era coming to a close. And it brought, it reminded me of, in some respects, of how different we are to
to the British in the way we think about these things. There's an awful lot of great similarities between the two countries, but also some very profound differences between us. And I suppose the postscript to that article maybe was Fintan O'Toole's column on Tuesday, which he concluded by saying, "Up the Republic," and in which he argued for the superiority of the Irish system against the Irish Republican system against a monarchy. But that was they were the pieces I thought were most worth reading this week.
Yeah, I'm going to choose an article by Joe Humphries. He does his Unthinkable philosophy column every Thursday. I read it religiously every week, and that's not just because it's on one of my pages, so I have to read it. I think it's well worth reading. This week he's writing about correlation and causation, a subject which is quite useful to think about in relation to politics, and various debates about how useful causation is and how it can go wrong. There's an interesting parable about a woman called Tamsin. Only in a philosophy column can you have a woman called Tamsin who doesn't get wet because she brings her umbrella out and it doesn't rain. It leads her to conclude that the decision to take an umbrella is the cause of the rain in itself. And this is, I think, held up as a bad way of thinking, except I know that every time I don't take out an umbrella, it does rain. So actually, I know that in this case, causation does actually exist, no matter what Joe says. So that's my favourite article for this week.
Post hoc ergo propter hoc, Hugh.
Precisely. Couldn't have put it better myself. Harry.
I had to go with that article, and I must say I found it hard going when they started talking about physics, the difference between physics and philosophy. Unfortunately, I realised that this was not going to be one for me. Very, very high concept stuff. I went for a slightly more accessible article this week. It was Hilary Fannin's column actually from today, and she was talking about the occasion of the late Queen Elizabeth's funeral, and she started off by saying she bought an apple slice and intended to eat it in front of the television while watching the pageantry. She has difficulty watching royal pageantry, and she thought she might be able to watch Queen Elizabeth's funeral, but she gave up halfway, and a little bit like myself on Monday, I tuned in the morning to have a look at it, and they're walking down in procession towards Hyde Park, and I had lunch, went for a run, got my hair done, went for a trip to Tullamore and back. I came back, looked at the television, and they were still in procession on the way down to Hyde Park. It does go on for a long time. But what Hilary marvellously does then is she segues a piece about Queen Elizabeth's funeral to a piece about Gwyneth Paltrow and the Queen of Goop. And it's a marvellously written, funny piece, as you would expect from Hilary Fannin. And so that was my favourite piece this week.
Yes, indeed. Hilary, Keith and Joe are three of the jewels that adorn the crown that is the Irish Times, and I'd recommend our listeners to read them every week. But that's it for this podcast today. This podcast was produced by Declan Conlon. We'll be back in your feeds next week. But until then, goodbye and thanks very much for listening. And don't forget your umbrella. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.